For me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis with Claire Press. Join me every week as we look at sustainability, ethics, and the business and madness of fashion. Fashion loves to pay lip service to diversity and inclusion. But how often do you hear class being discussed as well? Today's episode looks at what my guest calls perhaps the biggest issue, because it's the gateway one, when it comes to a lack of diversity in fashion's power positions and elitist spaces. This goes for the arts more broadly, right? Now, we're going to be focusing on Britain, although, of course, you find this everywhere, but Britain has a particular obsession with class. And I'm going to quote from a Vice article by the London-based Singaporean writer Kay Leong. It's titled, "Foreigners Reveal What Shocked Them About the British Class System." And she writes, "In the UK, everything you do, where you shop, what you eat, how you live, is a reflection of your class. According to a study by LSE, some people are so obsessed with these cultural markers that they present themselves as poorer than they actually are, even when they're stinking rich, with a privately schooled actor and the son of an architect both identifying somehow as working class." And she writes, "People talk about the lack of overlap, how classes stick together, the smugness of judging others by their accents and postcodes, and somehow equating that with a level of education." Ooh, yuck, right? It makes you shiver. Okay, those things are false narratives, but class barriers are very real. Middle-class people are twice as likely to work in the creative industries, where a third of the workforce is actually upper middle class. And consider intersectionality. Race compounds things. Less than 3% of people working in museums, galleries, and libraries in the UK are people of colour. It's just crazy. And we're not even getting into gender and sexuality. This headline from the Evening Standard a couple of years ago stood out, and I have it in my notes. "Creative industries are dominated by straight, able-bodied white men living in London," research finds. I mean, it's so galling, isn't it? And yet, is it changing? Why is it still like this? And what can be done about it in the fashion world? This week's guest is my friend Rahimur Rahman, designer, educator, and founder of the British Bangladeshi Fashion Council's new Bari Incubator, supporting creatives in East London. As Ray says, in order to make change, you've got to be in the room, not screaming from the outside. We recorded this in person last summer when I was in London. And while some of what we discuss is definitely confronting and upsetting, as it should be, listen out particularly if, like me, you're a privileged white person, for the bit where we talk about voluntarily giving up your power rather than just talking about it. But what I love about this chat is how friendly and accessible it is. I'm not sure how you discuss this heavy stuff and somehow enjoy yourselves while you're at it, but we pulled that off. Now, buckle up for a fantastic conversation with Rahimur Rahman. And don't forget to check the show notes for links. Also, if you appreciate it, please do help us share this episode. Welcome to the podcast, Rahimur Rahman.
Hello.
We're going to have a conversation about class barriers in British fashion. Your work as a mentor and a menswear designer and an educator. You lecture at St. Martin's and you've got this new organisation that you're working on. That's what I want to talk about, the British Bangladesh Fashion Council. So we've got a lot to talk about.
Where shall we start?
Actually, we should start with the fact that we haven't just met. We've actually just been on a weird holiday together.
I know. What a great time. What a great time.
We have a mutual friend in Ursula de Castro who has been on this podcast. We'll share a link to the episode if you want to listen to her. She's the upcycling queen.
And an absolute mentor. Like, I love her to bits. And I just think, because it's one of those things where finding people who think similarly to us all is the hardest part, especially in the industry that we're in. So when you meet them, you gravitate towards them and keep them close.
You know, it's really nice. I mean, I feel like I wasn't just name dropping Ursula, but it's nice that we made this connection on this very lovely trip that we made to another country to attend a party that Ursula had something precious to her. But what is nice is that when you find people of like mind, when you're working in a purpose-driven activism space, You make friends, don't you?
No, you do.
It's really nice.
Because you already have a great foundation to bounce off of. And obviously, I've known of your work for a very long time. But then to speak to you, like, personally was even better. Because then I was like, oh, wow, this is what drives her even more. And I was like, and it just was very similar to what a lot of people in that space when we was in New York, what all of us are driven by. And that was nice.
We hatched this plan to discuss this new organization, Bari.
Yes, which I love the name of. I'm to be honest, like, it was an extension of a project called My Home, My Bari, which I started, when was it? 2021, and I was the one who designed it. It was about a question that was given to me about why there are not enough South Asian creatives in the industry to pull from to work in industry. And that was the issue that I had with. So I was like, I'm going to be part of the solution. Bari in Italian and in Bengali means village or a house, like a space where people live. And I like that because a lot of the Bengali community in London have either migrated straight from Bangladesh or have done this tumultuous journey to Italy first and then to here. So the ones who I work with are all with that. And that's why I was like, Bari makes sense. It's this idea of like, it takes a village, which I love. I love a cliche as well. So I was just like, so the mentorship, I was like, we're going to call it Bari because it's different to all the other incubators that I've seen and have been pushed towards me. Because I'm just like, no, because what was missing was this community collectiveness of critiquing each other, of being able to say, actually, no, we can do better. And actually having this like, no hierarchy of like who's leading it. Because even though I'm leading it, I will be sat at the table with them being like, we can do better because I'm almost at the same level as them. And that's how I see myself. And that's what I like about this incubator, because I think it's about bringing people on together to think about entrepreneurship in a different way that isn't about being big and bad and this like massive business. It's about being able to create these like niche little companies that can just do very specific things, but do them very well. And that's what I want to help them build.
What's the aim then broadly with the program initially?
To have more South Asian businesses that are sustainably driven, that think about material people, who their consumers are, and to really think about redesigning their own business models. And where there's going to be 10 designers, each will probably have their own business models. But the important part of the program is having someone from finance come in and teach them how to do taxes, and then work with them to kind of like do their taxes as well. I work with someone called Vikram, and he will be working on the program too. He's going to come in with his advisors to help them understand that. Then having someone from like branding and marketing to get them to understand how to speak to this new generation, but to speak to your niche community, how do you reach out to them? Because it's not always through the TikToks and social media. Sometimes it is word of mouth. And how do you like work with that to make it a stronger business model?
In many cases, is it that you've already got these kind of core skills where first or second generation Bangladeshi families and immigrants have got these sewing skills that are amazing, but they haven't connected with the fashion industry or haven't figured out that business?
Exactly. And that is ultimately where the incubator is for a wide range of people. And I'm trying to, I've already got people who are in communities who are just really good at doing embroidery, and she only does the embroidery on her like daughter's top. How can we get her to understand that this skill set that she has, that she probably is looking at very small and is thinking community very small, like program, is something about she can actually build this into a business and actually branch out? Because another program that I'm delivering with the British Bangladesh Fashion Council is this co-op, and it's about helping women in the community who do have these skills, where tailoring is just very innate in our community. We do it all the time. Eid is coming up. Eid is on Wednesday. So everyone will be making their garments anyway in their homes, but it's getting them to have more skills, pattern cutting skills, seam skills, to that then if they wanted to, they can branch off and become their own independent freelancer, or they have the autonomy and agency to kind of choose to be like, no, I actually want to stay with this co-op. Within the co-op is about serving the community, where all these people will be buying things and they will help them alter and tailor them to their bodies.
I want to talk more about your experience in your own community and where you grew up and how you got to this place of fashion design. But before we do that, I thought we might discuss class and race in Britain.
I know. I mean, to be honest, like that's one subject area that I talk about a lot, especially class, because I think where I have been reading a lot about race, and obviously I've experienced a lot of race issues growing up in London as well. It's just that what I saw was overarching was actually class issues, where a lot of the times whenever I saw things happen in my community, it was a dividing between class. And I grew up on the Isle of Dogs, which is very different as a community in Tower Hamlets.
For listeners who may be on the other side of the world, give us that in a nutshell.
So the Isle of Dogs is in London in the UK, and it's a very small area that's changed so much.
East
London, and it's changed so much in the last 20 years. It initially was an area where there was a Millwall Football Club, and for anyone who knows anything about English hooliganism, it was just that. And I was like, I remember being like 4 years old, walking to school.
Bit scary. It's white supremacist scary.
It was like, I mean, like we used Thugs. To see the yeah. assault. Like I've seen my dad get beat up, and like they used to throw stones at us as we was going to school. And initially when it started off, it was like all the POC communities together, and it was the white communities in the area who were connected to the Millwall football team, and that was the fight divide. And then it shifted.
When I just said thugs and scary, I was thinking, am I being guilty of stereotyping and generalizations? But you've just told that that's what it felt like.
That's what they were. I mean, to be honest, like I wouldn't find any other words for them, but they were thugs and gangsters. They used to run in families. And then the shift that happened was when 9/11 happened. That's when we saw the black community who were with us suddenly were moving over, and it suddenly was about religion all of a sudden, because then it was like all the Muslims, so that's Somalians and all the Bengali community in East London, and then it was like the Indian community, everyone else joined us, was against the black and the white community. And then that's when I realized, oh wow, well now we're not talking about just race, now it's about religion. And then it obviously changed even more, and then it was about wealth. And then I saw Canary Wharf change, and obviously that's when
gentrification
happened. And then I saw that divide, and obviously this is all in my early teenage years. And then trying to build a career off that was even like crazier. So
how old are you?
I'm now 32.
Okay. I just want to stick on this British class question. If you're listening to this in another country, and we have listeners all around the world, and if you haven't experienced life in the UK or visited for any period of time, you might actually not understand. Actually, if you live here, you might not understand it, but you might not know the depth of absolute obsession that people in this country have about class. It's so weird. For a bit of context, I pulled out an old article from The Guardian. It's back in 2014, where the fashion editor at the time there, who was actually an American, was writing about how baffled she was by a documentary that was on the TV then about the magazine Tatler. It was called Posh People Inside Tatler. This journalist was like, the staff there write ridiculous articles about what the colour of your Labrador says about you while shouting, "My father went to Eton," and laughing at poor people. "But sitting on my sofa at home," she wrote, "the show didn't feel like an expose of the Tatler world. It felt like a microcosm of Britain itself." Yes, there's all these stereotypes around posh people, but actually at every level of stratification of British class, you've got these weird obsessions and opinions about who represents what and what status lies where. And people here are really interested in where your postcode is, where you grew up, what school you went to. And then they make these judgments about where that puts you in this class strata. And then if you add in race and religion and cultural background, you get a messy complexity that sort of locks people in a certain place that is hard to get out of.
100%. And I think especially with the way that they lock you into those like worlds, the only way out, which was always pushed towards us, was this idea of a rags to riches story.
Oh, but that's so awful. I was going to say, in America they do that, right?
I mean, to be honest, it still happens here.
But the in America, where they have class in a different way, less of the, I'm sure it actually happens everywhere. I mean, I'm from the north in England, where you would get that kind of distinction of, are you stupid because you're from the north, from southerners? But then that thing about what school did you go to does happen in other countries. But in America, there's this myth of American exceptionalism, where the rags to riches thing, where supposedly as an immigrant, you can arrive with nothing and then become a Wall Street billionaire. But it's not really true because there are so many barriers. But here, I think we don't even want you to do that. We want you to stay where you are.
I know, which is one thing that I saw all the time. And for me, what was weird, because I saw that and I was like, I can't stick to it because I almost have to follow the protocol that was set in front of me. So like, even something as weird as like the way that I talk, none of my siblings talk like me. I'm the only one who's kind of tried to adopt this like slightly better speaking way. And I learned that when I was 18 in retail, when I used to work in luxury fashion in retail in Selfridges on the second floor selling designer shoes. And I just remember very similar to the women from the Tatler, very, very rich women, elderly, would come in carrying a Birkin and had a dog. Because obviously
a little dog under your arm.
Always, or in the bag. And they would always say to me, like whenever, because I would always put on this like posh voice to serve them. They're like, oh, you speak so well. This is so lovely.
Oh, because they would presume you couldn't. Yeah, because you didn't look like you should. Because
I couldn't. So then I learned that very straight away from that moment that, okay, if I speak like this, it's going to help me get into rooms. It's going to help me change my life. And
so
then
you pass as a certain thing.
Exactly. I know I'm white passing enough that I get to meander in these spaces. But then also, this is why I do these incubator things, because I realize from a lot of people in my community, I'm the most white passing, which is why I know a lot of my success has come to me, because I've been able to go into these rooms, speak about my work, speak about my culture, my religion, to be palette worthy for them, that they can understand it. Whereas a lot of other people that I grew up with, and I still have this like anarchist way of speaking about it and being quite rebellious and activist in that way. But I realized in order to make change, you have to be in the room. You can't be screaming from the outside. And this is something that was told to me very young. And that's ultimately what I'm trying to do, is get into these spaces. And now that I'm in them, and now I have this privilege, even though in comparison, it's actually not even that much privilege, because I come from such a below working class background. I just know that I've got to use it in a good way. And this is why this incubator is here. Because I'm just like, I have to be able to maneuver some of the networks that I have in order to make sure that other young people who come after me don't have to do this like white pleasing stuff, which is changing your voice to sound more palatable, to be more understandable, which is sad, because obviously what you said about Northerners as well, I've got loads of friends who live in Bradford, cousins, and they also did very similar things when they came down to London. They had to change their accent in order to be taken seriously. And I do that tone, all that stuff as a joke, but actually it's so real, because all of us have done it, and all of us now we're in this world, and we're all very driven to kind of change in that. One person who I've met quite recently is Anita from Diet Parata.
Diet Parata? Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Oh my God,
genius.
No, she's amazing. She started it back off Diet Prada to create this space for South Asians, but she is does not change anything about herself, is very much has a very Australian accent and just maneuvers very.
You need to talk to her. I've never come across her.
Oh my gosh,
her.
She's amazing. You will love her. Oh my God, I will introduce you, because we've now had to create our own nepotism in a way, because we don't have, and this is what I speak about a lot, we don't have an uncle who's in finance who's going to do all our banking for us, a far distant cousin who's a lawyer who's going to help us write all of our contracts. We don't have that. So we have to almost lean on each other to do that. And I learned doing that very young as well, which is also which was very different to my peers. So I just knew in order to make change, I had to be the change. And there were so many times where I wanted to give up. And obviously we know this through Ursula. It is very hard to try and do that. So you kind of just like stop and you kind of take a moment for yourself, and then you're like, no, get a grip. There's a bigger agenda. And then you just pick yourself up and you keep going, which is so late, and it's so hard to kind of do while you're still living in this like really horrible space. Because the new thing that I'm kind of dealing with in speaking about class, race, religion, is sexuality, which I don't talk about a lot. And actually that within these South Asian communities is also very technical trying to talk about. So most times I don't talk about it, because I'm just like, in order to get the community on side, in order to get funders on side to make change for the community, adding the complexity of like gender and sexuality usually will put people off, and it's so sad. So in my mind, I'm just like, I'm going to do it the holistic way, where I was like, I'm going to invite these people into these spaces. They're going to see a very queer man serve them and work with them. They're going to be very queer people who come and talk to them, and in a very soft way they're seeing the community without me being like, this is the agenda, even though it is my agenda.
God.
Which is super late, and I know it's never that easy, which is why I just know with like a lot of my friends like Richard Malone and stuff, we all are dealing with these complexities of class, gender, sexuality and religion and cultural backgrounds that we come from.
Well, it's intersectionality, so they're all layered. There is no single injustice when you layer all of the different prejudices that you have to deal with on top of each other.
But class, I think, is definitely the biggest one.
Back on this class thing, because I think it's when we were hatching the plan for this podcast, I was saying that this is an under-discussed topic, to my mind, in fashion. And yet fashion is incredibly classist. The reason I started with Tatler was that actually a lot of posh girls...
Fashion is a love talking about class.
Yeah, but also a lot of these posh girls that go through Tatler or Condé Nast, which owns Tatler and end up at Vogue, are very, very privileged posh girls who daddy pays for your Chelsea flat, and it doesn't matter that you only earn pittance because, you know, daddy will give you an allowance. And actually, I think we talked about this with Georgina Johnson on her episode, and we can share a link to that. But that keeps these spaces exclusive. And I don't see it changing. We do, of course, there is a push to examine the lack of diversity in magazines like Vogue. Mm. But you could look at not just media and publishing, but publicity, luxury brands, all of these linked spaces that are dominated by these posh kids.
I mean, for me, that's one of the biggest problems I see with fashion at the moment is where we're speaking about race and diversity. A lot of the people who are being brought into those rooms are from the same class background. So actually the conversation isn't changing. It's just changing the race of someone and actually making no change actually is no change at all. And for me, I definitely see that from the get-go because I will be in spaces where they will bring me in because I'm white passing and they will think that I'm like posh like them. And then usually I'm very... very forward and will tell them. And usually the people who bite back or fight back are usually the people who are of my same race or from different POC backgrounds. And that's when I was like, wow, actually, you don't understand anything about the change that needs to be done because you're benefiting from the system that is saying that they need to diversify. Well, actually, they're just saying they don't want to change. They just want to change the faces.
Just want to shift the representation a bit so that it looks better.
It just looks better. And that's the thing. Whereas, and I know from the time that we've all spent talking about it, where we want system change, but that is a very big, scary task. But actually what's easy is a plaster and usually a brown plaster or a black plaster. And actually then it's easy. And without name dropping or changing anything, there was a very big talk that I went on by a big fashion in conglomerate in the UK, and they were speaking about diversity, but actually everyone that they brought on to speak about it were from very wealthy backgrounds
and in positions of power
and still hold them and will only employ and bring in friends who are from that background. And then all of us who are on the call who are from working class backgrounds, we have our own separate WhatsApp group and we were just like, what is this mess? Yeah. And actually then that's when a lot of us are slowly starting to tap out from a lot of these machines, I would call them,
the big corporates,
because they don't understand it. They don't understand the change that needs to be done.
Recently, you were interviewed for a Vice article for a story titled "What's It Like Being a Creative When You're Not Middle Class or White?" And in that article, the writer, who's brilliant, interviewed various people, but she also raised some stats, which I thought was so eye-opening. Middle-class people are twice as likely to work in creative industries where a third of the workforce is actually upper middle class. And she wrote elite private school or raised by a nanny territory. And then also things have gotten worse. So in the 60s and 70s, when the art school landscape allowed free education for anyone from anywhere, background-wise, with a creative bent, that's now fallen apart because, of course, you don't have free grant system education. You've got to pay a fortune. If you haven't got that, you're not going to be able to cover the fees, never mind your living costs. But then she said, if you look at the makeup of creative professions and industries, I just pulled one stat out because I just thought it was eye-opening. In museums, galleries, and libraries, less than 3% of the people who work there are people of colour.
I mean, again, with that situation, because I think, especially because I've now found myself working with museums and archives, and a lot of the people that I work with, I was asked where they've been educated. And a lot of the times they are very like MAs and PhDs. And when I went to do a talk at one of them, it was all white women who, very similar to the backgrounds that you said, are very wealthy. And you can see from their voices, it's a Surrey or somewhere like that. And they're sat there trying to understand from a POC experience what they could do better. But what I took away was actually what they were learning was how to speak about POC people better without losing any power from themselves. What they were trying to do was actually understand from us specifically, from the horse's mouth, how can they be better? And that's when I've stopped doing these talks. I don't do these talks anymore because I've realized what they do when they ask me to come on board is to speak, to show the models of stuff that I'm doing. And then obviously what I've seen is they've just mirrored or actually taken straight from what I've said and actually added it to stuff that they share out. And then I was like, oh, well, actually, you've missed completely the point. The point is to actually bring in someone who's working class and brown like me, who is very intersectional, very laid in their existence, that then they can help you comment on things like Black Lives Matter and know how to maneuver that. Even though I'm not black, I can have, through sympathy and through my friend network, to be honest, have a very honest portrayal of how to speak about that community. The trans community, I'm not trans, but I have so many trans friends, and I can. This is why intersectionality is important, because actually then you guide those conversations. But what they weren't trying to do that, they were just trying to understand how they could be that, and that doesn't change anything.
So if you're listening to this and you're a white person who holds power and you're feeling guilty, good, because that's what we need to do in order to then take the next step, which is to proactively try and change the system and give up the power that you have. And that is the massive stumbling block on this stuff, because people of privilege don't want to give up the power. Like you say, when I was listening to you there, I was like, oh my God, it's so sad, but it's also so, in a way, inevitable that these sort of do-gooding people who actually think they're better than their friends because they're engaging with the topic.
Exactly. They're like, I've read why I'm no longer speaking to white people. And they're like, I get it now. Like, you didn't get it, though. That's the whole point. You're still talking about it.
But I know that there are layers of complexity to how different individuals approach this stuff. And I'm not saying everyone's the same, but there is a kind of tendency, if you are a white privileged person, to think that you're somehow more smug and better equipped than your peers because you've read these books or you've tried to engage with this. And then all you do is go to a dinner party and talk about it. But do you actually make space, give up space, or try to change the system that has delivered unfair outcomes? That's where we stop.
And that's the biggest hurdle that we have, is people, and literally, like, that is hitting the nail on the head. It's about people giving up a little bit of their power to make room at the table.
Step back, which
POC people do all the time. And this is what I don't understand why people struggle with doing, because I have seen with the film project that I'm doing, all that stuff is about me saying, actually, maybe I'm not the right person to be doing this exact specific bit, but this person is. I will take a little bit less and you come on board because it's more important to have your voice at the table.
Should we talk about ego? Before we were recording, yes. we were talking about fashion ego, but I was just thinking.
But ego runs everything in fashion, to be honest.
But I was just thinking, just on a personal level, of the personal struggle that you have with your own ego that you wish to keep in check, but that as a self-aware adult, hopefully you see when it's out there. But for me, just on one example would be like, when I get invited to host a panel, and I'm delighted because then I get to talk about my podcast and promote myself. But I'm always saying to people, I don't want to be hosting that panel because I would prefer that you would have a much more diverse and changed kind of voice up here, and it wouldn't just be dominated by the same old people. But then when that starts to happen, because the system does change, there's a bit of you that goes, oh no, but I still want to be up there.
Yeah, no,
and the work has to be that you say, good, this is what we wanted. And I've been talking about this with friends recently, and the good news is it is starting to happen in sustainability and we are seeing a change. But if you need to be proactive in trying to make the change, but then you also need to push your ego aside and actually let it work. And I don't think people are very good at that in fashion. They still want to keep it, don't they? They're still greedy for it.
I mean, to be honest, I had a conversation very similar to that with a friend of mine who was asked to do a panel around race, because they very similar are a white woman, but they have done a lot of work around race. Mm. They were going to do it. And then I had this conversation to be like, let me explain to you why. And obviously, this is the thing where I've learned to speak very softly around race, whereas before I was very like, I got her to very softly understand why she might not be the best person, even though she's very educated and understands all that. So I was like, because there's a lived experience with especially the panel people who are coming on board that you're chairing. You won't understand. They might say something and it's very late. You might have read the book about their life, but you won't understand on an emotional level how taxing it is for them to sit on a stage and tell you their lived experience. Because a lot of the times, and especially now around diversity and stuff, people with lived experience are asked to come and retell their traumas to make the world better. But actually what they forget is actually everyone else gets to walk away and hear that story and move on with their lives. Whereas people like myself and everyone else who speaks about their lived experience, we then have to go back and be like, oh my God, I totally forgot about that. Fuck, that was so heavy. And then, which is why I'm so lovely with my amazing partner, because then I just come back and I just like, that was so hard. But then I understand the reason why I have to do it, because someone has to bite the bullet in the beginning. And I've got a fabulous mentor who still mentors me. And she was like, at some points, you're going to have to be that person. And luckily, through the training I've had through youth organizations from when I was 14 in art to my time at CSM with an incredible mentor called Bernie Yates, who works with widening participation, I just understood I had to be stronger in order to do that, because otherwise change doesn't happen.
But there's so much responsibility and pressure on you to change the system that you weren't the architect of, and it shouldn't be your responsibility to shift it. But I guess if no one in charge is doing it, someone has to.
That's the problem, is that no one in charge is doing it. Whereas initially with like even the incubator and this co-op that I've designed and built, is I've tried to do this under other people, and I've come with the hurdle that they don't get it. They don't understand why it's important for me to move funding specifically away from here and actually build and have people come in and speak to them about business and tax. Actually, they're like, no, they should just make stuff. But for me, that's the problem, is that actually I've seen so many of these programs, and I know I'm only 32, but I've been in community programs since I was like 14. So I've seen all of these things that just happen as like a glimpse and then they go away. People come with like 20 grand, 30 grand, 60 grand budgets, work with the community, and then do a project for 6 months and then they go away. Nothing in these women's lives get better. Nothing. And predominantly, it's always South Asian women, Somali women, Itahamlas, or young people. They just leave. And that is the biggest problem I have, because actually you can't speak about people and then not be there throughout their progress. Whereas I've been very lucky, and I know I'm an anomaly in that, where I've had mentors throughout, and I still have mentors, and I'm still 32 because I'm still trying to figure this out. And
also, I think that's beautiful though. We all need mentors.
And to be honest, what's really lovely is that my mentors are now, we lean on each other, because now it's become much more like a friendship, because they also need mentoring too. And it's this like back and forth. But what they have taught me is that you don't leave people behind. They carry along with the journey and you help all along. But that is the problem with a lot of these programs, is because they forget, and it's usually because of class, they don't understand the lived experience of these people, and they are speaking on it and then they're making changes on it, but they actually actively haven't got those people to the table to discuss how they want their lives to be different. What would they want in their community? What would they want in their businesses?
Do you want to tell us a bit about growing up in Tower Hamlets and what led you to fashion, and also what challenges you met?
Much like anyone else who's been to East London, there's a dark underbelly to East London, which I was very much a part of when I was young. So I'm openly gay now, but when I was young, I was very closeted, and I was a great actor, I will say. I performed that performance of a roadman, of like someone who's a gangster, very well. And that is where I first came across youth programs, because they were trying to continuously pull in people from the streets to be like, there's other ways. And then I came across a program in East London through a friend and his sister. We went in and she was doing a photo shoot and we were the two models, and we kind of played about. And then I was 16 at the time, I was still at school. And then I was pulled in by the woman running the program to do this like half-term project, and she kept like, she was badgering on. And you know, one of those people where when you're young, it's like, oh my gosh, she just wouldn't shut up. And then she coerced us by snacks, and that worked.
You're grateful.
And now I'm so grateful that she had tea and biscuits, because that really was the pull. So I came into this project, and then my friend dropped out 3 days after, but I stayed on because I loved it. Because it was because there was a queer tutor, and I was just like, well, seeing so much of myself in this program. And then to be honest, from that age till about 19, I was still with them. I did summer programs. I learned how to pattern cut. I learned how to make. It's a fashion-based youth organization in East London called A-Team Arts. And it was initially under Tower Hamlets Council, but it recently got its funding cut. And a lot of our alumni who are now all over the world doing phenomenal stuff, because of the mentorship that we had for years, we all came back to campaign for that money, but it didn't come.
Oh, it's so important these things are funded, especially when you've been a beneficiary of it and you know what difference it makes.
The silver lining is Bernie Yates, because she is a white woman. And this is that thing of like someone taking power, being like, it's not me, let's hand over. She did exactly that. She was the kind of advisory board, but kind of like a tutor on the program.
What's her professional background?
So she is a professional knitter, Bernie Yates. Honestly, anyone, check her out. She's phenomenal. She's a professional knitter, taught at St. Martin's for many years, then started to work within the widening participation team, because like her children are a rainbow spectrum of genders and ethnic backgrounds. And so she saw the disparity that they saw, so she wanted to make an active change. So then she started working in widening participation, which is where I met her, because she was working in the communities. And then through those many years and through her network of designers, she managed to get Alexander McQueen or Sarah Burton to fund the A-Team Arts now. So now A-Team Arts is now under Alexander McQueen Foundation.
I did not know any of this. How wonderful.
I mean, it's so great, because now they have the creative autonomy to do whatever they want. And now this program has built even bigger and better, and it's just going to funnel more children like me.
Sarah Burton, I've never interviewed her, but I'm very intrigued by her, because she's a quiet, obvious genius, but you never see her out there talking about herself. But she does all these wonderful things. Like, for example, when I was researching this book that's about to come out, I was like looking at which houses do make dead stock available before they had all these platforms to sell it. But, you know, who was willing to do it? And so many houses were like, no, you can't have that. That's our IP. But she was like giving it all away. But then she's also making McQueen pattern cutters available to students to help them with their projects. She's obviously quite community-minded.
That was a project I just saw recently where with 18 Mars, Sarah Burton, she brought in all the designers who were working on the current collection. It wasn't even like it was like the old things. It was the stuff that they were working on for the show. They brought the patterns, they brought the garments and let the young people maneuver and play around with those patterns. And these are all South Asian kids. Like, to be honest, it was predominantly, it's like a really big mix because actually it's predominantly South Asian area because it's in Whitechapel, but the area's changed now. So actually it's a class issue because actually there's white students in there, there's Somalian students. It's about kids who can't manage to break that glass ceiling type of thing. And she did that. And actually I really commend McQueen for doing that because then it showed them how far they can go. Because when I was on the program, at the time it was at McQueen, it was Burberry they were working with. And the Burberry Foundation came in very similar, brought in all the designers, took us to their studios, made us sit at the desk and kind of gave us this like very immersive experience to tell us,
you see what's possible.
If you work hard, you could do this.
I don't know then, you see what's possible, but with a proviso, because before you said you were schooled in this idea of the only way to get out is rags to riches. You've got to be that one person who breaks through because of your luck and genius combined, but most people won't. That's also a problematic story, isn't it?
No, 100%. And it's one that's pushed continuously in the fashion industry. They love a working class story like McQueen, like...
Son of a cabbie.
All of that stuff. Even with Sadiq Khan, you know, he's like his dad, all that stuff. They love it, but what they don't want to do is support them.
Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, what's dad? I don't know.
His dad, I think, was also a cab driver, but they made this massive push about him being a working class Pakistani man. And actually, his son was just because he educated himself and was so genius, he made his way out. But actually, I know, like, it's just about who he knew that allowed him to push further and further. And that is where, to be honest, I think the credit most of the time have to go is in these programs that are built that don't get the credit. These youth organizations, these mentorship programs, these incubators that are small, but those little touch points that young working class people have that completely change their lives. And
I asked you about growing up, what did your family do?
So my mum was a housewife. I'm one of 9 children. So she had a lot of children to raise. And my dad worked in the garment factory.
I thought so, right. What sort of factory? What did they make?
So when I was very young, he was making jackets for Aquascutum. And at that point, it was called the rag trade. It wasn't like BFC. There was no fashion industry in the UK. It was just a rag trade. And I remember going to the factory and it was, to be honest, it still looks, he still works in there. Last time I spoke to him, the factory looks exactly the same, which is why I know slave labour still exists in London.
Okay, so Aquascutum, when we think about Aquascutum is quite famous as being having a royal seal of approval. I think they make the raincoats for the Queen, or they used to at one point. But let's not think that just because you've got these heritage products and they're made in England, that they're necessarily ethical or responsibly produced. I also remember reading about a story that came out in 2000. It was about Topshop. And it was an investigative piece that had revealed essentially modern slavery in factories in London back when they used to make some stuff onshore for Topshop. This was happening just around the corner.
It's 2023 and they still exist.
Do you think? Do you know?
I know because I can tell you exactly where they are. They're all on Commercial Road. There's about 4 of them. Commercial Road in East London is like near Shadwell and Whitechapel.
Immigrants without second language, don't know their rights.
It's people like my dad and all of his friends. Some of them found affluence by owning their own factories and then actually managing that. But I know that they still get paid by piecework. I know that the conditions within it are horrible. I know that there's fake floors made just to make more space for machines. It's not really clean. Like when you see it, it's like the very, very ugly underbelly of the fashion production in the UK, which is why there's so many amazing production houses, but that still exists and brands are still using.
We don't hear it. We hear about Leicester. Yeah. We don't hear about London.
And this is why, I mean, for me, it was really wild because obviously anyone who's listened and is Bengali and is from London will have family members who have worked in factories because that was the first thing that they all did. My dad was 9 when he came and that's the first job he got because his uncle worked there and he still works there.
And did they come from where?
They came from Sylhet in Bangladesh. It's the poorer side. It's the villages of Bangladesh. So what happened was that after the war, a lot of people were given like asylum in the UK and one by one, people kept bringing their family over, which helped them changed the lives of people who lived in the villages, but
sending all the money back.
And I grew up watching my dad send all the money back, which was really hard to see as a young person, because you were like, wait, but we're below the poverty line. The last time that I spoke to my dad about working in the factories, because I had just launched the brand and all of that stuff was happening about production, and I was working with Making for Change and I was working with like incredible organizations. I was trying to tell him that actually he doesn't have to work in these factories, that he could get a job as a technician because he's got immense
experience for so many years.
Yeah, and could work with young designers because I knew so many. But he was scared of that venture because all he's known is working in these factories. And then I asked to see it. And obviously this, and now I'm much older. So I was like, I want to see it from when I was young. Cause when I was young, I went with him as like this like playful son. And obviously all the other garment factory workers, they brought their children and we all just kind of played around. But what I once saw when I was older was actually the conditions. And actually the conditions of that factory was not very far off from the images that we see across many journalistic things that speak about how horrible it is in the global South. When I'm like, this is on your doorstep. And these are the people who built the fashion industry in the UK and are now completely left behind. The big aim is to hopefully change that. So actually then these factories don't exist in that way, but have found other ways to make money.
How do you think then that Bari could potentially change that story for, perhaps it's like tailors who are working at home, perhaps it's like people who have been working in these factories, but would like to have a different, more autonomy, like to run their own business. How do you think you could actually change it?
It's handing over the agency and autonomy to them. And I think that's the way, because a lot of the things that I've seen, it's about organizations holding on to that agency autonomy from people. Whereas ultimately with this incubator, it's me giving skills and just kind of going, this is kind of how it runs. And if you want to work in this way, you can. If not, let's completely shift and change systems. And you have the power to do that. And it's letting them kind of make the mistakes in a very safe space. But the main thing for me is getting them to understand that business is not scary. Because a lot of them, and myself included, grow up thinking business is scary. And I was very lucky with the mentors I've had to understand that it's not. But it just needs dispelling. And especially
You feel that you haven't got the skills to pull it off, or yeah, there are parts of it that are just way out of your skill set.
It is more the idea of not having someone to fall back on when it goes wrong. And especially with coming from a work-class background, I know it will always come back to that.
There's confidence as well.
Is that I don't have the confidence to make an expensive mistake, because the expensive mistake is going to be my life. And I know that's the fear of a lot of these women, is getting them to understand that actually we'll be there to catch them if it doesn't go so well, because of these amazing skilled Bengali people who have business now. And that is what I'm relying on for this program, is that over the years from when I was young, is that we have phenomenal business people who are all South Asian, who can speak Bengali. And for me, that's the main part, is to speak Bengali to these women to dispel these very complex ideas of contracts. They get scared of contracts. It's just to get them to understand. And sometimes it's quite simple, but in a language that they understand. And I think that is about breaking accessibility to these spaces. And hopefully the program does that.
What you just said there about can't afford an expensive mistake, I think is so profound. I mean, I feel like if you're listening to this and this sounds like you, then please get in touch and tell us. Because I feel like it's such a privilege to be able to gamble and take a risk, isn't it?
I mean, to be honest, even with my own clothing business, it scared me, which is why now I'm kind of in this lull period with the brand. Because I was like, what am I making? Do I know how to do business well enough? And then to be honest, seeing the gaps in my own ability is what really built this incubator.
Okay, so you went to St. Martin's. How did you get there?
Again, very luckily through Bernie Yates. She saw a spark and kind of just really mentored me to kind of push beyond, who exposed me to galleries, museums, experiential art, textiles, weaving not being a traditional form. We were weaving on the back of chairs. And obviously our program didn't have a lot of funding, so a lot of the times it was very haphazard, which I love. And actually that's become such an integral part of the way that I work.
That's the beauty.
And I love that. And she really taught me that I could do anything. And having somebody tell you that you can do anything, when the reality is a lot of the times it is in your parents and your family, is what was needed. And that's actually what allowed me to get to St. Martin's, because it was someone saying, you've got a dream, go and do it.
Are you also wowed with your brilliance? You showed, your collection was shown at the V&A. Everybody was talking about your work. And just tell us a little bit about visually what it's about, because I love the textiles and the textures. Would you call it menswear? Would you call it gender fluid, would you call it?
I just call it clothing. Yeah. I mean, initially,
did you do menswear?
I started fashion menswear at St. Martin's, and when I did my first collection, I did call it menswear because I knew I had to in order to get people to understand it. To be honest, like when I graduated, it was about craft. My final collection was about craft in Bangladesh, and it was just after Rana Plaza had happened. So I graduated in 2014.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
oh,
so that's right. So Rana Plaza had just happened, and I remember at the time, because I came from the streets, all of my work was around streetwear, about, you know, mix of like hip-hop culture in London, the dub scene, you know, grime scene in London. And then everyone kept asking me, as the only Bengali person, about Rana Plaza. And I was like, I knew nothing. I really knew nothing because I was born in London, had never been to Bangladesh. My parents did not have money to take us anywhere. I honestly, at that point, did not have a passport. So then I then had to read up all of it. And then I worked with this amazing artisan called Sharia in Bangladesh, who is still going, who was working with weaving. And I wanted to create beautiful weaves. I was like, okay, cool. Everyone is talking to me about high street stuff. I was like, I'll show them the beautiful stuff. Because I grew up seeing incredible saris, jamdani weaves, and incredible art, artisanry skill. And I was like, I'm going to speak about that in my final collection. And I did. And actually, it went down really well. And so I was lucky enough to be in the press show. And then I just remember getting all this like incredible press and then never knowing what to do with it because there was no mentor to be like, you should set up a brand.
Now what?
And then, so then I kind of went into this lull period of like, what am I going to do? And then I leaned on my other skills, which is teaching. And then I started to teach. And then while I was teaching, I started working for like weird fashion brands. Like there's a shoe brand called Underground England. I designed a trainer with them.
Didn't you work for LVMH?
I do. Yeah, oh yeah. Then I also worked for Louis Vuitton, and I was on the runway bags team when Kim Jones was there.
Were you?
Had a great time. But to be honest, that was when I really understood that I didn't want to work in high, luxury fashion. It was one of those spaces, and I don't know if anyone listening has worked in that industry. It's not a slate to you, but it's just the way that it runs. It's just how excessive it is. Like I remember making this lizard damier, and I will never forget it. To be honest, like it scarred me so much. I remember
that's
making this
the check.
The square patchwork piece that that's like damier. It's synonymous to their brand. They love it.
So was it actual lizard skin?
It was actual lizard skin because the brief was to make it was like a sportswear inspired collection, and I wanted to make these like little clutches that were like lizard for the very expensive clientele. And at the time, I was completely not sustainably minded at that point. And this moment was a catalyst that made me want to do it. I was painting these like specific blue colors on palettes, and all these lizard skin came in. There was a whole table full of it, and then I chose one, and the rest went into a box, and I knew it was all going to get incinerated. And I, to us, it's weird, that was like, oh my god, it's too many years ago, and I still think about it like it was yesterday, just because it was so excessive, just for this one little bag. And then when I remember seeing the bag at the end and then thinking about what got it there, and it just, I the balance was so off for me. So then that's when I was like, okay, I can't work in that, I can't numb that down. And then to be honest, then I kind of went into education. And then just before the final collection, I did this photo shoot for just for my Instagram, to be honest. It was because there were so many phenomenal South Asian women around me, and I wanted to style this shoot around this mixed identity that we had. And this was in 2017. And Sarah Mawa saw it at that point on my Instagram. And very luckily, and it's through the network, because obviously
Sarah's list.
She put you in the list. I was on the list. And then
for listeners who don't know what on earth we're talking about, what is that?
So Sarah Mawa is the voice of the BFC who finds new talent. And she has a thing called the Sarah's List, where she goes around the UK and finds the new talent. I was like really weirded out by it because I was like, I graduated and she obviously saw the work. And then I had a coffee with her and I sat her down. And then she was like, why did you not start your brand? And I was like, Sarah, with what was I starting a brand? I was like, I have nothing. And I was so honest because I had nothing to lose. That's when she put me forward for International Fashion Showcase. And then that's when I first heard of the British Bangladesh Fashion Council, because then they together were like, let's do something. And then they put out this open call to all the Bengali designers in London. And at that point, there was only like three of us. And to be honest, I'm still friends with them. Rukia Ullah, who's amazing, and Shama Kun, who's also amazing. We all applied. And then I was the lucky one who got chosen. And then I had to represent Bangladesh. And that was actually what changed the whole trajectory.
Tell us about Aranya.
So Aranya is a cooperative that runs in Bangladesh. It started just after the war in 1971 by an amazing woman called Ruby Ghaznabi. And she is a craft lover. and was also luckily a very wealthy woman who just after the war could use her wealth to make sure that the craft didn't die. Because where everything was just being bulldozed over, she was like buying and collecting and safe housing all the artisans.
Because of what, the story of factories taking over from craft production? Or?
Exactly. The factories were starting to take over because obviously now GDP was very important and craft was dying because a lot of people were being murdered at the time and because of the famine through the war. So then what she started to do was...
extremely grim.
I know. But to be honest, without her, Aranya would not be here. And then she mastered natural dye to be from Bangladesh and created this incredible range of textiles for the local market. And that sustained them. And then she then sat down and took away her position to then become bigger in part of Bengal Foundation to look after craft as a whole. So looking at journalism, audio, oral history, visual history, fine art. So she now looks after that. But then Nauşin Kher looks after Aranya now. And that's who I started having conversations with and who's helped me start my brand.
Would you be able to just tell us a little bit about some of the amazing craft heritage then of Bangladesh?
So Bangladesh is such a weird anomaly for me for craft. From village to village, they specify and are skilled on specific crafts. So if you take weave, for example, it grows all across West Bengal and Bangladesh with very different complex ways of weaving. Jamdani being the highest one, where at the moment, you can only see the high thread count in museums because it used to be about 1,000 thread count.
Wow.
And Queen Victoria loved it because this idea of being this
I'm
like...
I'm going to go to the V&A and look for it.
Oh my God, no, you have to because I have actually seen the archive.
Colonial plunder, but still, I can benefit. Have a look.
I mean, it is an incredible textile. You can't touch it with your fingers because it's so fragile. And Aranya are now working to kind of bring the craft level up. They've got up to about 350, 400 thread count. And that has now also been acquired by the V&A. And then this, to be honest, that's just one example, but there's so many... block print is a whole nother region where actually specifically in how you block print and how you lay that up, which I was very, very interested in. And then there's like...
we said shibori natural dyes. Oh, really?
Shibori tie dye as well. And to be honest, majority of all of them are use natural dye. It's the recent phenomenon of synthetic dyes, which is actually what's ruining it all. But what's really lovely with Aranya is that, especially under Nauşin Kher, is that she now has a chemist who works with them to try to make amazing colors. Because when I went to go work with them, all the colors were very muted, and I kept saying to her, be like, we need to be making a fuchsia pink, we need to be making like neon greens. And through I started working with them 2018 to now, we still have these like amazing conversations, and she is pushing that brand forward.
But to use sustainable alternatives, innovation, or
all of that stuff, and for it to be insular within their system. So then they reuse their own water, they have a very small community who live very close to where the artisans are.
But so synthetic dyes, but in a more safe usage model, or
she doesn't use synthetic dye at all.
Wow.
It's how can we mix science and nature to create very vibrant colors? Because we know strawberry is only going to get a specific type of pink, but if you mix it with like a specific type of mordant from a banana skin, you can get like a very different
type
of color.
Yeah.
And I just had a vision, and obviously I just thought, I was like, I want to have, because I love pink. I was like, I want a bright pink. And obviously now they've got a chemist who's like working on all these colors, which I'm very excited for. And they do workshops all over, but they specifically market to the local market.
Often when we talk about heritage, we think of it as like this dusty thing that we need to save and compromise around. Mm. But I love how you're talking about actually heritage and innovation together. And
oh my God, that's it.
We could be doing that if we weren't so sidetracked by just fast rubbish.
I mean, that's what I went to do with the block print that I did with Aranya, is that when I went to go see their samples, because they were manufactured for the local market, they weren't pushing the craft, they were just delivering what was wanted. And then, so then I had the chance to play, and I just remember this moment where we were layering up five colours, and obviously with Batik wax resist dye, it becomes very heavy and like waxy, and it's like this hard black rock almost. And then it gets dipped into this like boiling hot water, and then this fabric comes out. And I remember the process of doing that, all the artisans were kept being like, who is this weird international like London kid who thinks is Bengali, is like telling us what we should be doing? And then I just remember in that moment there was like 25 of us around this one pot, and this fabric came out, and they all were like, oh my God, like that's when they first, and to be honest, that's when I first felt like they respected what I was here to do. And that's what we need more of, is creative innovators who think way beyond and outside the box, who go back to these heritage crafts and push them forward for a modern market. Because for people like myself, because I was like, I want to wear natural dye, but actually, how can I make that appealing to me? And to be honest, I was usually my own filter to be like, would I wear that? Do I like that? Is this like gross enough that it's amazing? And to me, a lot of the textiles grew from that. I was like playing with embroidery and stuff, and I didn't like all of them, but yeah.
I love this so much. We're running out of time. We should do this twice. But I want to end then on advice. And I do think that's a relevant question to ask you because you're teaching now as well. What advice would you give to your younger self?
To not care about money so much and care more about social impact. And if I thought about that from the beginning, because one thing where I know you need money to sustain, but funnily enough, you'll find a way to sustain yourself. But what you won't be able to sustain is how much of your own ethics and principles you curb to the side in order to make money. So one thing that I would love to say to young people, and myself included, even now, is forget money, make change, because the world needs it. There's so many emergencies happening everywhere. And if we as designers don't think about to redesign models that we see that are just not fashion, are society models, finance models, political models, to look at our creativity to be a vehicle to actually change things, that is the best advice I think I could give anyone. And to be honest, even as I'm saying it now, I'm like, boy, you better listen. You better listen to what you just said.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. You can find the show notes for each episode over on our website, www.thewardrobecrisis.com. And that's where you can also sign up for our free sustainable fashion newsletters. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd love you to help us spread the word. Tell a friend, share on social media, or leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find us on the app. You can get in touch with us on social media. The show is on Instagram at The Wardrobe Crisis, and I'm on there too. And on Twitter, I'm at Mrs. Press. Because I love you.